Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Mark Bullen in this episode. Mark is a consultant in distance education, e-learning and educational technology with extensive experience with the Commonwealth of Learning, British Columbia Institute of Technology and the University of British Columbia. Mark and I talked via Skype. It gives me great pleasure to be talking with Dr. Mark Bullen, educational consultant and adjunct professor in the UBC Master of Educational Technology program. Mark has a broad history across distance education, e-learning and educational technology with a very rich international exposure. Mark, it's great to be talking with you.
Great to be talking to you.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mark. Can you give us, just to start with, a brief overview of your career and publications?
Okay. Well, career goes all the way back to, the early 80s when I started out as what we called at that time a project manager, but really was an instructional design role at the University of British Columbia in a department that was called Guided Independent Study, which was an interesting department that sort of evolved out of sort of a correspondence education-based department that was responsible for the distance education programs at the university, which at that time were almost entirely print-based. And my position there sort of evolved over the years, and then we started to incorporate more technology into these distance education print-based courses, started to use video heavily. And we started working very closely with another organization in British Columbia at that time called the Knowledge Network, which was a television-based educational service that was distributing TV, what they called live interactive television programs. And we were working with them to incorporate some of that into our print-based programs. And then at some point, I went back to finish my master's degree in educational psychology, and then also did a PhD in adult education. And there was a lot of sort of organizational change going on at the university at that time, and guided independent study eventually was absorbed into the continuing studies department at the university. And I took on more of a management role, I think in late 90s, early 2000s, I became the assistant director of distance education and technology. And that coincided with the arrival of Tony Bates, who took over as director of the Department of Distance Education and Technology. Well, it wasn't called that when he took it over, but once he took it over, he decided to rename it, which I think was a more appropriate name for the department, because we were starting to use much more technology and moving away from a print-based orientation to distance education. In any case, I became assistant director and then at some point associate director. And then in the mid-2000s, Tony retired and I took over as acting director and was there until 2005. In the last two or three years, between 2003 and 2005, the department went through a significant reorganization where the university administration was trying to basically decentralize the department to the faculty. So at that point, the Department of Distance Education and Technology was a centralized support unit that supported the development and delivery of distance education programs across the university. And there was a lot of pressure from faculties to take that over so that they could manage it themselves, driven primarily, I think, by a misunderstanding that, that somehow there was a lot of money in this and that they were missing out on a huge opportunity. Anyway, when they finally, despite what we told them about it, that there wasn't a lot of money, at the last minute when they actually sat down and looked at the numbers, they realized, yes, there was a lot of revenue, but there was also a lot of costs. And if you split those costs across, you know, 10 or 12 faculties, the efficiencies are lost and it's probably, you know, they weren't going to be making any money. So the last minute they backed off on that plan to decentralize. But by then I had become so disillusioned with the whole process that I ended up moving to another post-secondary institution, the British Columbia Institute of Technology, where I started out as the associate dean of their Learning and Teaching Center, which was another central support unit, but much larger, surprisingly, because the BC Institute of Technology was a smaller institution. It wasn't a university. It was they called themselves a polytechnic institute, but really a technical college that focused on applied programs and technical training and vocational training. But they had a very strong central learning and teaching center. So I took over that position as associate dean and then stayed there from 2005 to about 2012. In the last few years, I was actually the dean running the organization. And then 2012, I was actually planning to retire. In the meantime, between the time I decided to retire and the actual retirement date, I had found an opportunity at the Commonwealth of Learning to work as an e-learning specialist and was quite interested in that, and they offered me the position. So I thought, well, I might as well work for a few more years, took on that position, and stayed there for 2 years working in a number of Commonwealth countries around the world, working with governments and government agencies to help develop their e-learning capacity. And that so that ended in 2014 when I finally did sort of officially retire, although I still teach in the UBC Master in Educational Technology program as an adjunct, and I'm sort of peripherally involved in some work that former graduate students are still doing, research is still doing, but I essentially call myself retired at this point.
That's an incredibly varied career. I'm quite interested in the fact that you worked for both a distance university and also a polytechnic. That's my background as well. I'm wondering if you could just comment a little bit on the differences in teaching and learning across those two institutions. The polytechnic probably a lot more vocationally oriented. Can you just comment on some of the teaching and learning differences across those two?
Yeah, well, definitely the polytechnic, the BC Institute of Technology, much more vocationally oriented and much greater focus on teaching and less on research. It was easier to get sort of institutional support for efforts that focused on teaching, whereas at the University of British Columbia, which is a research university, there was much less interest in really pursuing teaching excellence because there were a lot of people at UBC who were interested in doing that. But as an institution, the primary focus was always on research, and there was always a struggle to get the sufficient focus on teaching and improving teaching. Whereas at BCIT, although they were starting to move very heavily into applied research, they understood clearly that their mandate was teaching. And that they needed to focus on that and try to improve it where necessary, and try to ensure that the faculty that were hired with good teaching skills. And so they at BCIT, they had a teaching certificate that all new faculty had to complete before they were actually formally hired. Whereas at UBC, there was no requirement for any kind of teaching skill, and it was really up to individual faculty whether they decided to pursue that. So that was a very obvious difference. The other difference that I found was that there was a much greater acceptance at BCIT of the notion of a strong centralized support unit, whereas at the University of British Columbia, because it was such a large institution, the faculties were basically in control. And, some of the faculties were so big that they kind of operated sort of semi-autonomously and resisted the notion that there would be any kind of central department that would have any kind of authority over them. So there was always that tension at the University of British Columbia, whereas at BCIT there was by and large an acceptance that having strong central support units was a benefit to the institution.
Yeah, that would mirror my own experience, actually. It's good to hear that story.
Yeah.
Mike, you've done a lot of research over the years, including a lot of work on digital natives. Can you just discuss some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided over the years, particularly those that you sense are still pertinent for us today?
Well, the interesting thing about my career is that I think I've done a fair amount of research, but I've never been in a in a purely research position. So I've always been in working as an instructional designer or working in an administrative position as a manager, assistant director, associate director, deans, and so on. And so research has always been something that I've been very interested in and tried to pursue, but it's always something I've had to do sort of on the side. There's one thing about when I look back on my career that I wish I could have done more of, it's research. But nonetheless, I did in the last few years of my career, starting in about 2008, I think, was when we initiated this research into the whole notion of the digital native and tried to sort of look at this whole discourse. And the origins of that were really that I discovered as, I think it was in 2007, 2008, this whole discourse was really hitting a peak in terms of the way it was being discussed in higher education. And there just seemed to be an acceptance, sort of almost an unquestioned acceptance of the kind of basic notions or ideas that were being put forward by people like Mark Prensky and Don Tapscott, the idea that young people born of a certain generation, just by the mere fact that they were born at that time and the fact that they were exposed to digital technologies, had a sort of a profound impact on their ability to do certain things and the way that they interacted with the world and their understanding of technology. And so there's all sorts of claims about this entire generation. And it just struck me as a bit of a stretch. And so we decided to look into that and say, well, what is there actually any evidence to support that? But the first thing we did was we just did a survey of all the work that had been written on this topic. I was going to say research, but really what we discovered that there was almost no real solid research that had been done, very little. And most of what was being discussed by the people like Prensky and others was really just speculation. It was just sort of their thoughts about how young people were interacting with the world and technology based on some assumptions. But there was very little solid empirical research that supported their basic fundamental claims. And so that was the first thing that we did, is we published some work on that. And then we actually conducted some of our own research at the British Columbia Institute of Technology, looking at students there and trying to find out whether they actually matched the kind of profile of the digital native and how they perceive technology and their use of technology. Yeah. And what we found was that there really wasn't a match. What we discovered was a number of institutions, including our own, had plans for making significant investments in technology based on these assumptions of the sort of digital native discourse. And we thought that didn't make any sense to be investing significant amounts of money in technology when the underlying evidence for its use wasn't there. We sort of ended the first phase where we said, okay, there is no digital native. That whole concept is really unfounded. But we do recognize that something's going on, that young people are coming to higher education with different technologies and a different outlook on life, and they're using technology in ways that weren't used in the past. And so we wanted to try and understand more about that and dig a bit deeper into that and see how they were using technology in their daily lives with social and recreational purposes, whether there was any connection between that and how it was or could be used for educational purposes. Because that was another thing that we found in our research, was that there was a real sort of confusion about the context of technology use. There was just an assumption that if you used it for social purposes or for gaming or whatever, that just mere fact of doing that would make you an expert, sophisticated user of it in other contexts. And we thought that was questionable. And so we wanted, in the second phase, to dig a bit deeper into that. And we did a little bit of research, but by then I was close to retirement and some of the other people involved in the project moved on to other jobs. Tanis Morgan, who I know you've interviewed for this series, was one of the other key investigators, and she moved to the Justice Institute. So they've kind of lost the ability to continue that second phase of the research, which is unfortunate. But in the process, we did work with at least one or two graduate students who have since continued to pursue those lines of investigation. But what we had hoped for was to turn it into a much bigger kind of research project that would continue, and that unfortunately did not come to pass, because I'm still tracking the research, and there's still articles coming out that start with the premise that, you know, all people of a certain generation have these characteristics, therefore we need to do this, this, and that. It's been a difficult one to really slay.
With the benefit of hindsight, I think the whole digital natives, digital immigrants distinction that Mark Prinsky claimed, and also Don Tapscott, of course, researched with quite a small sample in his book, it seems a bit like groupthink. We all wanted to believe it was true, and so we basically made it true.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what we said, is that there was a sort of an intuitive, it made intuitive sense. You know, you see young people with their phones and their technology, and you think, well, they seem so expert at this, you know, and it sort of made sense that these young people were somehow different than previous generations and must have expertise. But when you scratch the surface, you realize that the way that they're using the technology is quite limited. And so they may be expert in one particular aspect of the technology, but that didn't necessarily, well, it didn't transfer to other areas, particularly to educational uses.
Mark, we're coming up now to mid-2019. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? What are some key themes that you would talk about from your current perspective?
I think the thing that strikes me the most about online learning is how little has changed. Because I've been teaching online really since the beginning, since 1997, I think, when I was at UBC, and that was where I think was the first learning management system, WebCT, was developed, and we developed the first one of the first. Always have to be careful about claiming to be the first at anything, but yes. One of the first online programs at that time, which was the precursor to the current Master in Educational Technology, but it was the Certificate in Technology-Based Distributed Learning, which was a graduate certificate program that was delivered entirely online. That's 1997, and I'm still teaching a variation of that program, which has evolved into the master's program in 2019. And when I look at, you know, the kind of architecture of the program and the technology that's being used and the teaching approach and so on, it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, the learning management system we're using right now is Canvas, so that's different. Yeah. But the architecture of Canvas is really not any different than the original WebCT, and the tools are a little bit more sophisticated, but fundamentally not much has changed. And so that's the thing that strikes me. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but it strikes me that in how many years that's been, 23 years or more, that you would think there would be sort of a more of an evolution in the way that online learning is being delivered. But it seems to me what's really happened is the technologies have become a little bit more sophisticated and flashy, but the underlying architecture and teaching approach has not changed.
That's interesting. So do you think we've missed something there, Mark? Is there some potential promise for online learning that we've missed, or are we doing the right sort of things at the moment?
Yeah, so I thought about that too, and I'm not sure if we've missed anything. The other thing that I've observed, and I think the research has shown this, is that most of the way in which online learning tools like learning management systems are being used is at a pretty basic level. So, for example, if you look at the research on how LMSs are used in higher education, they tend to be used basically to distribute content. Mm. They're not even used to deliver full online programs for the most part. And so I think the technologies that we do have, particularly the learning management systems, are really not used to the extent that they could be. And that's partly due to the lack of interest in teaching at higher education in universities. There's much more of a focus on content. So I think that's an issue in terms of, you know, real full online programs that are being delivered, whether there's more that could be done in terms of the sort of innovation and creativity and how they're delivered. I'm not sure. The program that the course that I teach tends to get pretty good feedback from students. And I always ask them, you know, what kind of suggestions they would have for improving it. And they never tend to be anything, you know, substantial that would sort of totally reorient the way the course is designed. They tend to be fairly minor suggestions. So from the student's perspective, I'm not sure. But On the other hand, we shouldn't always be just assuming what students want is what we should give them. So we need to think sort of outside the box sometimes and force people, their students, to do things that maybe they, you know, they don't want to do if we think it's better for them. So I don't know, I guess, is the answer.
No, it is a very good answer because, to be honest, I don't know either. Mark, let me sort of take you back into research mode. Imagine you had an unlimited research budget. How would you apply it? What research would you most like to see done at the moment?
Looking at how higher education institutions are organized to support online learning and e-learning in terms of different organizational models, you know, centralized versus decentralized, the use of learning management systems, for example. One of my great frustrations in the last few years has been the troubles I've had with learning management systems and the difficulties in using them, the frustrations in getting them to do things, being able to use them simply without having to invest a lot of time and effort in learning the technical details. And it just strikes me that we need a bit more research on, you know, what is the optimal way to deploy technologies like that in universities and higher education more generally. The learning management system has now become kind of a default part of higher education. It's sort of almost unquestioned, and they're very expensive. But I don't think anybody's ever done any research to determine what value is do they contribute to the overall institutional goals and objectives, and, you know, is the money that's being expended on learning management systems really of value? Or are there other ways that we could be supporting the things that are being, that a learning management system is being used for? Are there other ways we could do that that would be more cost effective and easier to use? And I've given presentations and talks on, you know, using a more sort of do-it-yourself approach where you don't rely on these enterprise-wide solutions for things that are fairly simple. So I don't know if that's a very clear answer, but I think research that focused on those kinds of issues of institutional organization, how enterprise-wide technologies are supported, the value that they provide, and that kind of thing, I think would be an area that I'd want to focus more research. And the other problem is that I think a lot of the organizations, the professional associations that have sprung up to support online learning, in my view, have sort of become almost like lobby groups for the technologies rather than, you know, informed or organizations that provide kind of informed perspectives on different options for technology. They seem to be promoting online learning without accepting the idea that perhaps, you know, maybe it isn't the right solution at all the time, or maybe there's some context where it shouldn't be used, but just sort of this blind push to support online learning regardless of context.
So some critical research too would be quite worthwhile in your view.
Yeah.
Great. Perhaps similar to the contributions you've already made in the areas of digital natives.
Yeah. Well, that kind of critical debunking of, you know, of accepted sort of myths. We need to do more of that with educational technology.
So, Mark, I'd like to finish with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning. So one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
Yeah, I was thinking about that question, and it's really difficult to make those kind of recommendations. I mean, the one person that I don't think you've interviewed him, the one person that I think it would be worth talking to is Stephen Downes, and I'm sure you know him.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure he's somebody who's currently influencing me, but he's somebody that over the years, you know, has alternately annoyed I can't think of the other term, but, you know, he's an annoying sort of gadfly who makes points that are very valuable at times, and then other times I disagree with him. But I think he's the kind of person that we need in our field because he doesn't accept the sort of orthodoxy. He questions things, and he's been around. The other thing is he's been around for a long time and seen the changes and the evolution of online learning. You know, he's been central to the development of MOOCs and his sort of theory of connectivism, which I, you know, have problems with, but I think it's worth, you know, examining and considering. So he would be one person. And then I was thinking, you know, the problem with recommendations is that we always tend to recommend people who are from our own sort of either our own country or our own region. So I was trying to think of somebody from another part of the world. And one person that I've become, I don't know well, but I've sort of been following his Twitter feed recently, is Paul Prinsloo from University of South Africa. Again, somebody who I don't always agree with everything he says, but he's a critic and has some quite an intelligent perspective on things that I think is needed. So those would be two people I would recommend.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mark. I actually interviewed Paul a wee while back, a few weeks ago, actually.
Oh, so yeah?
His interview's in Train. It was a very, very good one.
Okay. Well, I'll need to think of another one.
That's fun. It's an interesting dynamic of the series that, I'm starting to get to the stage now where people are starting to recommend one another, which is actually quite good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll certainly follow up with Stephen. I agree with you. He's both annoying, but also sometimes really inspiring and quite thought-provoking.
Yeah,
I'll do my best to get in touch with him. Well, Mark, it's been wonderful talking with you. I've learned a lot over the last half hour. Thank you very much for sharing your perspectives and your history. And thank you very much, too, for being a legend and leader of online learning.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'm glad we were able to find the time to do this, finally.
You can learn more about Mark and his work from our website. His Twitter handle is Mark Bullen. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.